Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's good to see such a good crowd for Stormy on a cold February evening, and I didn't doubt that this would be a crowd puller. One thing I want to say in case I forget, the button that I've just pressed there, I hope means that that we are recording the lecture, and we're going to try to podcast it. We haven't done that before in the museum, so it's a first, so we may have missed out some vital ingredient from a machine that we only hired from a joint on the Carly Road just yesterday. So I don't know if it's going to work, but we'll give it a try. So hopefully, if you miss anything or if you want to tell your friends about the lecture, they should be able to hear it via the museum's website, hopefully within a few days, which explains why I might take a few flash photographs during the course of the lecture. I'm the only person who's allowed to do that, so don't think that's an invitation for you all to start photographing. That's my privilege. So I thought perhaps I should explain this. The event, the four lecture series, of course, is predicated on the International Year of Astronomy, which is itself derives from Galileo's first use of a telescope to observe the heavens. We in the history of science know something of the problems that Galileo had in relation to this novel venture. He had to work out what an Earth telescope was, what sort of technology, what sort of material technology it required, what sort of manual skills were necessary. That's one thing. He had to secure his position in the world. I mean, after all, not only did Galileo have a lowly paid job as a mere mathematician, and in those days it was a mere mathematician in the University of Padua, he wanted to be a natural philosopher in the court of the Medici, so he had to do some political work in order to advance his position. The telescope gave him the opportunity for this political work. So there was a political story to the introduction of the telescope, but of course there's also an intellectual story. I mean, he had to convince people that these things that he was telling them could be seen in the telescope were indeed worth seeing. That's to say, they were in some sense really there, that the distortion that the telescope relied on wasn't totally distorting, wasn't creating, inventing images that didn't reflect how things really were. So there's an awful lot of work, of persuasion, of rhetoric, and they had to get the stuff published and so on, and get it out there, convince people, hustle for attention, hustle for conviction, for belief among his readers. There's a whole slew of work which needed to be done, quite apart from the bits we hear about. That's to say, we hear about, you know, the mountains on the moon, the faces of Venus, the spots on the sun, and so on. But there's an awful lot more that goes into making a telescope, financing it, advancing your career, making it count in the intellectual world. And we thought, well, maybe it isn't all that different today, but it might be totally different, but I kind of suspect that some of the emotional side and some of the political side and the financial side and the patronage side and so on might have echoes of Galileo's work at the beginning of the 17th century. So being a museum of the history of science, we thought, well, we'll work with that, and we'll try to persuade a few eminent astronomers who've been involved with large facilities in the recent past, for shorthand, we can call them telescopes, though whether they're recognised to be telescopes in Galileo's sense, we'll hear. And I thought if we get some eminent speakers to come along and tell us what it was like. I don't know how much astronomy we're going to hear. There is, of course, astronomy involved, but there's also this other human, material, engineering, financial story in getting anything to work in at that scale in contemporary science, or contemporary science. So every Tuesday in February, fortunately February always has the same number of, usually the same number of Tuesdays, your calendar is marked. There's a lecture here at 7 o'clock where you'll be able to hear about modern telescopes and their building and use. Who better to start but Professor Alex Boxenberg, who, as you will know, was a director of the Royal Greenwich Observatory. And he reminded me when I mentioned this as the hook on which I would hang his the very short CV I'm going to give you, also of the Royal Observatory Edinburgh, and we mustn't forget that. But his career, of course, is divided between ground-based astronomy and space astronomy. So although we're going to hear mostly, I think, about the William Herschel telescope, we'll also hear a little bit about Hubble. We're delighted, Alex, that you're willing to come and kick off this exciting series, and can I invite you to take the podium. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If the PA of the amplification is wrong in some way, just cry out and I'll adjust it.
Right. Anyway, I've turned my bit on. So.
Good, yes, you have.
Right, well, thank you very much, Director, for inviting me, and particularly at this first occasion. I've got a lot to say, and I try and get it in the time. So, in fact, I'm going to put my stopwatch on. See what happens as we go. Right, now, I'm just sort of putting up a slide, which I hope is in focus, that more or less says what Jim said a moment ago. This is the issue about Galileo, not the issue so much as his experience, and what practical, the bottom here, political, technical, financial, and organizational challenges face telescope builders today. So I'm trying to address that. It'll be long and tortuous, it'll be coming from different angles, but there's an element of truth in it. So I'll see what we can do. Now I've just put in, I'm not going to do all this, but this leads to a whole host of things, which I don't expect you to read really. Leads to the fact I actually got involved in a certain telescope. So, just popping up here for a moment, I didn't come into astronomy intentionally. In fact, I avoided it intentionally. When I was at school, we were allowed to take a telescope home. I looked through it, saw some little points in the sky. In fact, I thought it was pointless. And so, I never thought about it. I did atomic physics, not nuclear, but atomic for my PhD. And at the end, I tried to get a job, and the only job I could get was in astronomy. So that's how it started, and I began in space, rockets, then balloons. Basically, these were to send payloads up. I found myself working on a satellite, which I somehow did rather well with, TD-1A, as it was called, very sexy title, isn't it? And then the thing called the International Ultraviolet Explorer, which took 9 years to build. It lasted 18 years in space. It sort of revolutionized ultraviolet astronomy. And because of the sort of technical aspects that I was concerned with, and by the way, not much astronomy. I was doing more or less technical things. I'm a physicist, but I was doing mostly engineering. I was asked to do something with the Anglo-Australian Telescope, which was just being brought in for the instrumentation. So my sort of brief was to look at the detector system. Generally, one was using film. This is going to be, you know, better than that. But we asked somebody to come along who was an expert, and he said, well, it will take 30 years to develop a really good detector. So I went home and got into the bath. I didn't do this intentionally either. I mean, it wasn't a sort of sequence. It just so happened I found myself in the bath thinking about this. And then I had an idea of how to do this now, at the time, with existing stuff, but just, you know, being a little bit intelligent about it. And it got called the Image Photon Counting System, basically for counting photons from objects and recording the signals in the computer and building up the signal. I'll show you this in a minute. And then, because of that, because it worked in the end, found it hard to get the money. The way you got the money then in those days was to go to the research councils. Let me say that again. The way the money when you find money today is to go to the research councils. There's no change. But nobody wanted it. Nobody believed it. The key people at the time said that, well, this doesn't work and stuff. An official in the research council, an administrator, said, look, I've got some money in my back pocket, go and do the things. Not a scientist. And I did it, it worked, it took off, and as a result, I went around various observatories observing with very good people. We called ourselves a flying circus, because we carried five enormous crates with us, with this stuff. And I went to Palomar the first time, actually, I went. Then I went to other places, Kitt Peak, Australian Observatory, various observatories. At Palomar, I met a Brit, Wal Sargeant, who was an astronomer there. He'd been sort of an expatriate Brit. And I said, look, I've got a detector system, and you've got telescope time, which is on the 5-meter telescope, the biggest thing going. And shall we get together within 5 seconds? We'd agreed this. So I came along with it. We had an observing run. We discovered a completely new branch of astronomy, cosmology, in fact. He didn't believe it at the time, because we had little traces going up and down on a bit of paper. And I sent him the plots in the end from back home, and I still had his Twix. We didn't have things like email or anything. We said, I am tremendously impressed. So actually, I'm not quite sure I'm telling you all of this, but I think it's sort of in the spirit of that. In other words, it suddenly became, I suddenly found myself in the thick of astronomy, but I still was not an astronomer. It was working with Wal Sargeant that one night I saw what it was about. Astronomy isn't looking at things. It is looking at things, but it's fundamentally physics. In fact, one needs the whole of physics to understand the universe. It's sort of logical. And in that moment, I suddenly a surge of confidence came upon me, and I was an astronomer. Now, if you check modern astronomers, you will find they're not astronomers. They're physicists or mathematicians. There are astronomy courses, but they're basically physics. And you have to have that. There are other types of astronomy where you're taking maps, you don't need all the physics, but you still need the appreciation. So, I became an astronomer. Now, at the same sort of time, there was a big telescope, in fact an observatory, being built, or at least planned for the Canary Islands. And these are a few words now, and I'll go through a lot of pictures and you'll see what I'm saying. It'll strike a chord. This observatory was related to the Royal Greenwich Observatory. The Royal Greenwich Observatory was the sort of key observatory in the UK. It had facilities, it had people, and it was supporting universities in general. Now, it began in Greenwich. Greenwich was not so good when London expanded, so it went to a place in Sussex, Erskine-Sue Castle. And that the people there were to design a new observatory, not in England or anywhere in the Britain, but in the right sort of place, because you can't do much from anywhere in Britain. And the place was going to be in the Canary Islands. Now, they were going to take some of the telescopes that were already there to the Canary Islands. But the really big one that was wanted, the William Herschel telescope, as it was called later, when they did this design, came to so much money, it was unaffordable, and it was going to be cancelled. Now, by then I'd been through a whole host of things to do with building telescopes that went into space, Hubble telescope included, and lots of instrumentation and so on. I looked at the design. I was not at the observatory, I was at University College. I looked at the design and wrote to the chief of the research council, chair. I said, you can build this telescope for half the price. And I'll tell you how. And I did tell him how, and you'll see. And he set up a panel, I led it, and we got a design for half the price, convincingly. And it was approved. And then I became director of the Royal Observatory. Because the previous director was just on retirement, and I became director. I mean, I did not even think I'd be director, but then I found myself director of the Royal Greenwich Observatory to build this telescope and build the whole observatory in the Canary Islands, which it all happened, and other things happened beyond. Now I will start slideshow. So let me start again with Galileo. Here he is with his telescope. I'm not saying it's to scale exactly, but you see the sort of thing. This is a refracting telescope, lenses. Somebody else came along. I think Newton was born just when Galileo died. he did a telescope, he did a different sort of telescope, again multi-scale, which is a reflecting telescope. You can see light goes onto a mirror, and then it goes onto another mirror, and the outer side is an eyepiece. And you, in other words, you don't have to get the wave of being reflected. And that's a different one, different sort from there. It has very many advantages, partly because it's easy to build. You just have to make one surface instead of two over one lens. But also the lens has to be extremely, you know, uniform in its properties, you know, the glass, whereas it's just the surface of a mirror. It has enormous advantages. I'll make that point again. I'm sorry, Richard, you pressed this. Now, then came William Herschel, and he built that telescope. Again, it's not to scale. This is like 40 feet or something. He really was serious about big telescopes. He made lots of discoveries and so on. Of course, Galileo made some amazing discoveries for the time. The moons of Jupiter. That's how we see them today. That's, in fact, shots from a spacecraft called Galileo, very close to Jupiter. Jupiter is on the left, the moons are on the right. The top moon is Io, and that's just an enlargement. This is astonishing detail. You can just see what's happening. What's more, it's active volcanically. You can see the spots are different from one to the other. These are volcanic sediments, which one can see being active. In fact, the volcanoes themselves are observed active volcanoes. Right, now, of course, it's a different matter today. Coming back to Galileo, Hubble telescope on the top there is just one space telescope. There's many, because many different types. If you get above the atmosphere, you can observe in any part of the electromagnetic spectrum, doesn't get obscured by the atmosphere. We are restricted sort of more or less to the, obviously, the visible region, and near infrared, near ultraviolet, and radio from the ground go up, go right into X-rays, gamma rays, and everything else. So it's not just Hubble that's fantastic in space. The Hubble telescope is a 100-inch telescope across. These other things, they're things actually in Chile. Right, so let me come on to this image photon counting system as I go. This is where it basically started for me, even though I've been doing space stuff. This is where the William Herschel telescope started for me. It's a device like that. It looks like that at the top, and that's the ground-based version. It was used in many observatories. And the bottom is the one that went up in Hubble. What it is on the left is an image intensifier, and the right is a television camera with a lens in between. And what happens is, with the image intensifier, you amplify the light so that a photon looks like an elephant. You multiply it by 100 million times. So what is received in the front, instead of being a bit of film, it's a sort of sensitive photoelectric surface, and it gets amplified in stages internally until you get a bright flash at the end, which is just from one particle of light from the beginning, at the beginning. And then you just have to see where it is in the field. You do that with a television camera, and there's some processing. Now, this is what the television camera sees. You can see the lines across. This is showing a sort of an A scale, A plot sort of thing, amplitude plot. But you can see those are photons, each one. And you make you process it, and they look like points in the center of those events. That's the fantastically strategic thing one can do to make the image absolutely clear. And this is done in real time. Now, in the bath, when I thought of this, I thought, well, the eye isn't just an eye, it's a computer. The retina does all sorts of parallel processing, and you can't possibly pass all that information down the optic nerve. What goes down the optic nerve is a sort of processed version of what you see. That's why you can fool the eye with optical illusions, for example. It's not actually what you see. It's been converted to some extent. And you can see motions. I mean, you see a spider on the right, this sort of thing, because it's moving. Actually, some people with damaged, part of the brain, where the light is, they, where the processing this, that one of the curious things, sometimes you can see motion, but you can't see what is moving. And it's, in other words, it's a lot of processing. Right. And you just let it build up in the computer, and up comes the image. It's photon by photon. It may take 3 weeks. But when you're looking at very distant objects with trying to get some sort of detail one way or the other, it takes a very long, these are long exposures, so they build up slowly. So, and this is the equipment you need, it's not just the device, this is 1970s stuff. It's on a spectrograph on the left, a spectrograph I'll come to, and the electronics is the big deal. In other words, one uses devices existing but does electronic processing in real time and post-processing that allows you to see what's happening. And it's like the brain. The eye is pretty crude, the retina is fantastic, and the brain is even better. And it's just that combination. Right, so that all worked. And we're looking now at the William Herschel telescope. So, there it is. This is the cut price version of the William Herschel telescope, which is better than the original design. Better in performance, much better. And I'll explain. This is part of an observatory. This is in fact the observatory of the Royal British Observatory on the Canary Islands. The Canary Islands are quite good. You see, I'll come back to this in a minute, but look at those clouds. They are down, not up. There's three telescopes there in a row that belong to four telescopes in a row. The William Herschel on the left, below it on the screen, is something called the Carlsberg Automatic Meridian Circle, which is to make positional measurements. On the right is a thing called the Isaac Newton Telescope, which it's a 100-inch telescope, the same diameter as Hubble eventually was. And there's another thing which is a sort of 30-inch telescope called the Jacobus Kapteyn telescope, and they're given this symbolic thing at the bottom there. Now, this is the, I just show this very quickly, the Isaac Newton telescope. I show it because of the mounting. You notice it's got a sort of a disc. That's a, it's called an equatorial mounting. In other words, it's mounted parallel to the pole of the Earth. And as the Earth rotates, you have to rotate in the other direction. And then it's still in the sky. You see, you follow the stars. You also have to pick a star, so it needs to have a motion in that direction as well. So you can see it's got a pivot, so to speak, that allows it to do this while it's rotating that way. And that's called an equatorial mounting of a pretty unique kind, but it is that. And that was based on that. But imagine a very much bigger telescope, much more weighted telescope. That's going to be a bit difficult, isn't it, that mount? So, oh yes, before we go on, how does one work in astronomy nowadays? Well, you don't just go along and use your telescope, and what's more, you don't even look through a screen, and there's a thing called a time assignment committee. Big telescopes, you have to bid for time, maybe a fifth of the application to get it, and you get a few nights on the telescope, you have to be very good. This is meant to make you laugh, which you haven't, not a single this is not how it's done. You don't keep them off the telescope. It doesn't get that far. Sorry, I won't do this again. Right. Now, we're onto the Royal Greenwich Observatory because that was the body which built the Canary Islands Observatory and which was to build the William Herschel Telescope. That's William. This is Flamsteed on the left. And this is how he operated. He had some transit circles, I've forgotten the name of transit circles, Jim, you know what they're called, sort of like sextants and stuff, that you got positions in the sky. He made a map of the whole sky. Newton wanted this, he didn't let him have it. The story's well known. There was a battle between them. And you also had a thing like in the top there, you could sort of look through, it wasn't a real dome or anything. And it's in the site of Greenwich Park, and it's, oh, I think that's called Greenwich Park. Anyway, it's where the National Maritime Museum is, and there it is. Later it became a more modern observatory, and it also kept time. That's the time board that went up and down, so the ships could see when it was noon, and they could reset their clocks. Later on it did the six pips, and so on. There at Greenwich in London, there were some telescopes like that. Now it became obvious we couldn't do much in Greenwich, and in the early 50s, the idea was to move somewhere else. But the site that was picked was at Hurstmonceux by the director. He liked it because it was a castle. And the statistics that were used were it was the sunniest place in the British Isles. Unfortunately, it was not the place with the clearest number of nights. It didn't sound so silly because there was also, but they were also doing solar research, but in the end the solar research was dropped. So it wasn't that good there either, but that was a nice castle. In fact, I lived in that castle for 9 years, and the ghosts were very friendly as well. And there were telescopes there. This is one example. But look at the sky. It was hopeless. In fact, I once got 70 nights before I got there as a director. I was at University College, as I mentioned. I got some time there on the telescopes, an enormous amount of time, 70 nights of time, because I had this detector thing. Six were clear. So it's not much good. But what you want to do is to go to a place which is not just clear, but has other properties. And one of the really essential properties is the seam. Now that sounds like a simple expression, but it's a technical expression. It's jargon. The seeing means how small is the image that you see in the context of the atmospheric motions that there are. And as you know, if you look along a road, you see a car or something shimmering away. Or if you see some of these natural history programs on the phone, you see some lions there, you know that they're miles away, that the camera person doesn't really get close because they're all shimmering in the heat as the air is rising. So you want to go somewhere which has very calm conditions. So go to off the west coast of a landmass, because the prevailing winds on the west will be cooled by the sea. Also, you need a high site. Now, there are islands here. La Palma turns out to be the best site, but not with the highest mountain, nevertheless the best site. Off the west coast of Africa, the level of the Sahara Desert. So that's what it looks like from the site. I've already pointed one example. That is not the sea or anything. Those are the tops of the clouds. You're above the clouds. There's the sun. Now, having got the site, some telescopes were removed, in particular the 100-inch telescope that I already mentioned, which had been built at Hurstmonceux. The idea was to build a really big telescope like others had, but better. In fact, they generally were 4 meters in diameter, not 2.5 like the 100-inch. But we were going to build a 4.2-meter telescope to beat the rest. And it was going to be something like this design. This is the team that was at the Royal Greenwich Observatory, about this size. And it's a pretty big building. I mean, you can't see it's big, but I can tell you it's an enormously big building. And if you look inside and see the telescope, I put another building the same size, the Anglo-Australian telescope, was built in the same size. And you can see there's an enormous cavern with a telescope in the middle. And what's more, this telescope is again a equatorially mounted telescope. It's 4 meters. And to make this work, you need an enormous yoke like that. And it's a lot of steel, a great deal of cost in the building of the telescope, and an enormous cost in building the building. People thought you'd keep the climate nice inside, and you know, the wind off and everything else. What you did was to again create this nonsensical business of air motions internally, because there's a lot of heat inside there, and it's all trapped. All the air is trapped. So it was wafting about. And where did you look? You know, a little slit in the dome, which is put together with shutters, and you're looking through an aperture where all of this air is going in and out. Just place not to look. So, and this, so from this point, the idea was to build a original idea is to build a building this size, without thinking about it, let's say, but a slightly different sort of telescope. It's called an alt-azimuth. Now, the reason that people built these types, this sort of telescope, with a very simple rotation this way, a very simple rotation the other way, Roger, I didn't see you before. because you could do it easily, you didn't need a computer or anything. So it was basically mechanical. If you take a device like this, it's the alt-azimuth device, mount. What you do is to rotate about a vertical axis and a horizontal axis, but you need complex motions to follow an object, because it's not just countering the rotations of the Earth. You're rotating in that direction, which is not the pole, unless you were on the pole, and you have to move this, you know, you have to complex motion. People say, well, we can't do this, we need a computer. So, of course, in those days there were those computers, but nevertheless, radio astronomers used them and so on. And it was decided, okay, look, let's take the risk and we'll do that. Anyway, so this was the design. However, it was, again, the old sort of design, in a sense of optics. It's a big telescope and a long focal length, comparatively speaking. They did their best, nevertheless. And let me just show you the size of the William Herschel telescope. It's like that. It's the same aperture, 4.2 meters, but much more compact. It's a shorter focal length, faster telescope, and it's got improved optics and everything else. So when one, I'm feeling embarrassed now, I don't watch it. When the so-called Tiger team, whatever it's called, looked at this cost reduction, which I proposed to Jeff Allen, who was the chair at the time of the Science Research Council, I made the point, basically, you could save the money by making the telescope more compact, not a less effective telescope, but more compact, and the building very much more compact. And in fact, the bulk of the cost is in the building. So when we finish, here's the telescope. Now you notice it's a very tight building around the telescope. Telescope is squatter, which allows one to make the building smaller still. And the dome is relatively small, tiny, let's say, compared with the old ones. Now one can do better than this, and one does. But the whole point here is to let the air flow through the dome. And there are ways of doing this with fans and this, that, and the other, but essentially there's not so much air to make flow because the volume is so much smaller. What's more, there's no heating in the building, because unlike the others, where everything was below the telescope, and the floor, there was floor upon floor upon floor of different things which just heated the whole building, anything you want is on the left of it, downwind, and the anything else that you needed was somewhere else completely. In fact, it turned out to be put in the Isaac Newton telescope. So this was the compact design. By the way, what you've got here is a mirror. Before I go on, there's a mirror it's the main point of it. And you need to luminize that. You need to make it reflecting periodically. So on the left there, that sort of shaped thing at the top, in the offset building, that is a luminizing plant, where one takes the mirror out of this telescope and re-luminizes periodically and puts it back. And all the gear that you need for that is put into the telescope. Done. Okay, so this is a structure, and the light comes down onto the mirror, up again, and one way you operate it is to go through a hole in that primary mirror, which is a disc you can see, to a focus behind it. So in a way, all you're doing is trying to find a way of manipulating a very thin layer of aluminium and maintaining the shape. That's what this is all about. You have to point it somewhere and you have to maintain the shape. And how do you maintain the shape? Well, you can have an active, or effectively active, mount. It's I'll show you a schematic of it in a sense. I'll show you something that relates to it. You don't just place the mirror on something, and this was done with old telescopes in a passive way before. You place the mirror on it so that when it moves, it gets counterbalanced in some sense to keep the shape. Now, to do this in the old days, you had needed a very thick mirror because it had to be basically stiff. Nowadays, one can have a very thin mirror and actively control it as you move it. This is halfway on this telescope. It does have a sort of an active mount. And just let me go on though, there's another focus where you, just like Newton, you take a mirror on the light that is it's coming from a second mirror back, but it's just not quite like Newton's telescope, but you bring it out on the axis, through the hole in the axis where the telescope is being moved. That's called the Naismith focus. Well, it's not really a Naismith focus because that's for equatorial lines. What is it for? It relates to that. It's a fixed focus, basically. We're fixed in the sense it's not moving around space, and you can put very big instruments on that. Here's an example. I'm sorry, don't read the writing, don't have to. But you see in that position, there's a laboratory. And on the right-hand side is a big box. That's an actual laboratory. It was used for all sorts of experiments in interferometry, image stabilization, all sorts of stuff. And on the left-hand side is a high-resolution spectrograph. These are big things. If you try to move them around, which you have to do if they're put at the other focus side, at the top is a prime focus, bottom, you put instruments as well, but they move around, then it's very difficult making those instruments. I'm not going to ask you to read this, but every box counts. In the middle there's WHT, that's the telescope. Everything else is instruments, supporting stuff. Each one of those things requires development and maintenance and design, of course, in the first place, and everything else. It's complex, a bit more complex than Galileo's telescope. And this is, of course, done by big teams. It's not done by single people. It has to have a large set of, a wide range of expertise in electronics, mechanics, and science, and anything you can think of, to make and maintain such a telescope. And not just that, civil engineering. The telescope itself is in a building, yes, but it's a special building, apart from it being heatless. There's a pillar, you can see a blue thing, on which the telescope mounts. That goes into the ground. The building around it doesn't touch it. It goes on the side of it. The building around it is shaken by the wind. But the pillar in the middle, where the telescope sits, doesn't get shaken by the wind. And you, of course, it's obvious you don't want that. So there's a complex civil engineering process here. It's even more complex because you're sitting on top of a volcano with loose ash about you, and it has to be stable. So everywhere you look, it's high tech. And there you go. That's the mirror. That's the thin layer of aluminium, so to speak. That's the mount, where each of these is pushing up at different pressures, keep it stable. As it goes, as it moves around, you know, it can be vertical this way, it's not crushing on itself, it's all sorts of fantastic things. Right, that's being built, that's the major mount. This was done at a company, Grant Parsons, which doesn't exist as such now, but it was basically Steelworks. It had a very good group of making telescopes, but it was basically steel. They did the work, as you just saw on the mirror, that was what they did at the time. As we got to the time of shipping the telescope, the company went out of business. We got the bits in crates, which we had to ship to the Canary Islands. That was true of all the telescopes, in fact, one way or the other. In fact, one telescope, a 30-inch, which I'm referring to, Jackal's Capstone telescope, was taken by ship across, and a Harrier jet had run out of fuel and landed on it. That was fine. We should have charged salvage. But there were several problems on the way. However, we got this stuff in crates, and we got a team together, which engineering team, which put it together. We built the telescope. We, being the Royal Greenwich Observatory, I mean. We got advice from Grant Parsons and other companies, but they had disappeared. So anyway, here it is. This is the building was built by someone else. Not, I'm talking about the telescope when I say the company. The building, of course, is built by a different sort of company, and Freeman Fox and Partners have done design for that. And there is progressing, as you know. And there it is, yeah, with the clouds below once more. And that's the dome, and that's the big slit that you have open. A lot of air can get in. There's a small volume. It keeps it fresh. It doesn't allow heat to accumulate and everything else just right. In fact, that first light is produced astonishingly small images. It is amazing. As time went by, it got slightly worse. There is some heat, and it makes a big difference. But you can cope. Right, by the way, that's the telescope inside. And all that's happened here, you take a long time exposure and rotate the dome so that you basically the slit goes past, and that's what it looks like. So you can see it's tight in the dome, could be smaller even. And originally the idea that I put to the research council was you make it like a shoebox and make it just squeezed around the dome, around the telescope, which all it has to do is go up and down and rotate, so you make the building rotate as well, which it does anyway. So why not make it more compact? But cold feet happen, and we didn't do that. Later on, people did that. And that's what it looks like when you make a time exposure on the sky. Look at that. It goes down to the horizon even. You can see the stars. So it's a really good sight. Right, so that's the telescope in the dome, and that's the top of it. Secondary mirror, remember there's a mirror here, the light comes down, it converges to a secondary mirror, puts it back down again, and when it's down it can go either through the hole in the primary or be diverted to the, what I call the Naismith platforms. Right, and that's underneath. Now, most of the instrumentation that one uses is in fact put below. And it's generally a spectrograph, but it's also imaging. Now, you don't just simply take images with modern telescopes. One has to analyze the image. In fact, the big advantage of a big telescope is that one can take quite make an intricate analysis of the light. Spreading it into the colors, it tells you something. We'll come to that. But just to see what a spectrograph is, there's a slit on the left top there. You must sort of define light. That's the focus of the telescope. And then you make the light sort of parallel and put it onto what's called a diffraction grating. I'll come back to that. And then having come off the diffraction grating, it's already dispersed in different colours. And then you refocus it onto a detector. And that's basically a spectrograph. Now, you look at a prism, you can see, you know what a prism does, it spreads the light out in different colours, like a rainbow. The diffraction grating does the same. It does it with far greater finesse. You can get far greater, what's called resolution. So it spreads it out much more. But you know what the hell is a diffraction grating? I expect you wouldn't know, actually. But if you don't know, you've got a DVD, you look at it in the light, you see the colours. It's parallel strips, parallel channels, where the comparable to the wavelength of light, and it's spread, when the light reflects off it, it has the effect of diffracting it. Longer wavelengths come off at different angles from shorter wavelengths, and you get a spectrum. Right, and that's what it looks like inside, and I won't dwell on it, but it's complex. That spectrograph I showed you, that was just in outline, under the telescope is, I'm going through this again. And that's the sort of general appearance of it in this particular case. And by the way, the IPCS, I mentioned, the image photograph system, is, as you can see on the top right. Okay, so what is a spectrum? What did it do for you? Well, if you just take this sort of simple picture here. On the top is a light, tungsten light bulb, not, by the way, one of these low energy ones. They work different. A tungsten pot, tungsten one, a prism, which I just put figuratively, and there you look at it, and you see a continuous spectrum, because that's what the tungsten light is. It's hot, and it's continuous spectrum. If you've got a hot gas, there's atomic effects happening here. And basically, if it's hot, atoms are knocking into each other. They knock electrons that are going around the nucleus up a bit, and they drop down again. And when they drop down, they emit the energy that they took in when they got knocked up. You get a very specific bunch of lines, as you can see in the middle there, very specific. That could be said to be hydrogen. In fact, it's something like it could be hydrogen to me, with H alpha on the right. If you have the same gas, but not hot, that's cold, and you shine light through it, then in the same transitions, you see absorption. Because the light that you're passing through is basically being used up in the wavelengths that where these transitions can occur by knocking the electrons up, so it's lost. And so that's what you've got. But then it tells you something about the gas. And indeed, the middle one tells you something about the gas too, when it's hot. So this is an example. I was asked to do something about Hubble as well. Here is Hubble. This doesn't have to be Hubble, it can be any telescope in fact, but there you go. And there's a quasar. Quasar is an immensely bright galaxy, at least the nucleus of the galaxy, and it's powered not by nuclear fusion, as are the stars, but by gravity. Sounds odd, but it's immense gravity, like a black hole that matter is circulating in, and the loss of the release of energy from this process, this gravitational process, can beat nuclear fusion by factors of 10, so or more. So it's immensely bright, and you can use it as a source in the background, and let the light pass through, like on that from that bulb passing through gas, except we're passing through the universe, because this quasar can be a very long way away. So this just gives you an example of three clouds in the way, where the first cloud at the top left makes an absorbing line to the right of the spectrum, that black thing. But you go to the, follow the light down, the next one is an additional one that it comes from the second cloud, but it's closer to us. That's significant. And the third one makes yet another, which is further to the left, and that's closer still to us, the observer. And the reason they're shifted is that the universe is expanding. And at different places in the universe, as you go further and further away, the objects are moving faster away from us. It's simply because the universe has a sort of uniform expansion rate. If you go twice as far away, you see things moving twice as fast. Three times as fast. It's not as simple as that quite, but it's that sort of thing. It's space which is expanding. So if you're in the space, other bits of it will be moving at different rates from you because the whole thing's expanding. You can think of, as people often do, surface of a balloon, a couple of points on the balloon. If you blow the balloon up, they get further and further apart. You have three points on the balloon. The first two get further apart, and the second two get the same further apart if they start the same distance. So between the first and the third, it's twice the distance between the two, twice the speed as you blow. That's actually what you see here. It's the redshift. The universe is expanding. The further away things are, the higher is the recessional velocity of the redshift. Okay, that's what you see. And this is a spectrum taken through the universe with a quasar on the background. You see a thick cloud, a thick sort of forest of stuff at the top, and that's due to hydrogen in the universe. And on the bottom, where one can see metals, heavy metals like carbon, silicon, etc., there's fewer. And the picture is this, basically. There's a lot of hydrogen about in clouds, and there's some galaxies about. And you can detect this by the absorption lines. In other words, it is an analysis of the light which gives physical information about the universe. And that's what mostly one does with telescopes. You analyze the light. You see the picture, you have to. But you do something with that to do some physics with it. So that's how you go. Now, why is there gas in these galaxies? You know the stars. These sort of circular, these elliptical things, galaxies, pictures. Sorry, artist's picture. It is incidental. The word evolution is significant. The further away you go, the longer the light's taken to get to us, and therefore the younger are the objects as you see them. You can see back in time. I don't have to tell you this, you know this. I can't see you in the front row. I can see you as you were if you're like 7 feet or 8 feet away from me, 7 or 8 nanoseconds ago. I can't see you now. Same thing, I can't see what you see coming from 14 billion light years away is nearly at the beginning of the universe. So you can see the history of the universe as well as the geography in three dimensions. And the point is, it's evolving. That's why I pointed to this word evolution. You can see the universe is not the same as it was now as it was then. You could literally see the universe evolving. Now, this is, I started saying, what's the gas? Well, here's a picture, a really dense region of our own galaxy with stars. They're not bigger and smaller, it's just the sort of apparent spread in the detector. It's not literally spreading out so much as the stars, it doesn't matter how you observe them, it's above the atmosphere, this is a Hubble image, or below the atmosphere, it's not a point like that, it's got a skirt. So if it's really bright, you're seeing further down the skirt. If it's faint, you only see the top bit because the rest is too faint. So the sizes aren't real, they are just how you see them. The colours are, there's different colours. There's some very bright, there's some very blue stars, they're very young. There's some very red stars, they're very old. And there's some blue stars which are old as well. And some blue stars which are a million years old. That's it. They're almost dead. It's a whole range of properties for stars. The bigger the star, the quicker it burns out, and the brighter it is. When I say burn out, it's not burning like coal, of course. It's nuclear fusion at the center, and the fusion process begins with hydrogen to helium, and then helium to carbon, and so on, in stages. And these produce, this is where the energy from the starlight comes. So, there's a gas, it's not just stars, but gas in our galaxy. And that's what you're basically seeing in absorption. That's actually the Eagle Nebula, with a famous thing in the middle there, on the side there. As you've seen, this is also a Hubble image. Sorry, this is not a Hubble image, I think it's part. In the Hubble image, you see detail, the central thing, which looks like pillars. And this is a place where stars are forming. It's active, the galaxy is totally active. Stars are forming because gas is compressing, the stars forming begin to fire when the gas has fallen in on itself and heated and so on. All of this is very complex, but in a sense also very simple. There's a difference between biological structures. They're very complex, full stop. You can actually, not quite true, but one can tell how the universe began, how it evolved and where it's going. But you cannot tell how an ant works. It's too complex. So while there's a lot of sort of detail, it's not complex in the sense of being, the understanding. If one looks around our own galaxy again, with a scale like this, this is the Milky Way. You see stars everywhere. Look, it's concentrated in the Milky Way, but there's a lot of dark stuff. That's not absence of stars, it's dust obscuring the light. I'll come back to that, sorry. I didn't go so quickly. I'll come back to that. That's our own galaxy in the middle. At the bottom is a couple of nearby galaxies, the Magellanic Clouds. They are galaxies. And there's many others, actually, that we are sort of eating. As the universe evolved, it began, and I'll show you some examples of this, with little bits of galaxy that in a hierarchical form, merged together. We are still merging we're still eating other galaxies. This is merging. The stars, though, aren't just lost in terms of gas. Many of them, and the sun will be one of them, go through a life cycle where they go up a bit. The sun will go up rather gently. It will turn into what's called a planetary nebula in about 4 to 5 billion years, and produce these rather nice things. I've put these up because they're so pretty. But these are the remnants of a star with the white bit in the middle. It's called a white dwarf, and it's the sort of core ash of the star. It's not doing anything else. It fades away, but it's small, and therefore, and very hot, it takes a long time to cool because it's small, the surface area is small. The gas that was around the outside is gone, and you can see it going, it's still being lit up. Before this, it started as sort of a red giant, because the hydrogen is burnt to helium, the process stops, the core collapses, it starts at 10 million degrees centigrade, or Kelvin if you want, and goes to 100, and then helium fuses to carbon. So I won't go into the whole host of things that happen. It stops at some process, it turns into a supernova, because when you get to iron, when you compress it, try and make it fuse, doesn't give energy out, it takes it in. And the core suddenly collapses, and the bounce is a nuclear, is a mechanical explosion, it's a gravitational powered explosion, which the single star can brighten to almost the brightness of the whole galaxy. And this is the remnant of one, it took about 1,000 years ago, where the gas is obviously more chaotic than the previous slide. But it isn't obviously more chaotic, take that back, but it actually is. And it's expanding. This stuff goes into the sort of atmosphere of the galaxy, but enriches it with heavy elements, and that's where they've been produced in the star. Before the stars were formed, there weren't any heavy elements. The universe began with just hydrogen and some light elements, helium, and that was it. It's only when galaxies were formed and stars that the heavy elements came. And now, when stars are formed, they are enriched already by the previously the previous contributions from stars, as was our sun. So our sun does have heavy elements, and that's, you know, we're listening to each other because of that. Okay, so here's a nearby galaxy, about a couple of million light years away, Andromeda. You can see the remnants of sort of, you can see some sort of dust there too. There's a lot of stars, obviously. There's an edge on one, you definitely see the dust on that. Another one, interestingly, edge on again. These are all different galaxies, and yet another one is so rare. There's dust and gas in all of these galaxies. There's different types of galaxies. Another one, a long star formation here. This is full on. See the spiral arms on this one. And enormous amount of activity. New stars have been formed in the arms. The pink stuff shows you where it is. That's hydrogen glowing. Okay, so what's this picture? This is the deepest picture ever taken by anybody. It's the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. In other words, it's a long time exposure with the Hubble telescope into the making a borehole into the universe. Now, the Hubble Space Telescope has a tiny field. There may be, I can move this just a little bit down, you can see different types of galaxies. You can see on the right, the bottom there, you can see a spiral galaxy. There's many red ones looking, surprisingly, they're sort of fluffy red thing. There's more galaxies that go back to the first one. You can see galaxies. There are about three or so stars in the whole field. You can see one at the top because you can see the spikes, which are caused by the telescope, it's diffraction by the telescope. And there's another one a little way down there. But the rest are galaxies. Now, in our own galaxy, there's 100,000 million stars. And in the observable universe, there's 100,000 million galaxies. And you're seeing some here. Not only are you seeing the galaxies, you're seeing them back in time. The little bits of you see there are fragments at very early times in the universe. These will eventually coalesce into things that look more like galaxies, almost in the foreground in this picture. This is a three-dimensional picture. You see the tiny things which are very far away. They're not just looking like the bigger ones, but just smaller because they're far away. They are smaller. This is measured. And these are fragments. These are the initial fragments. And they come together and so on. This is computable. One can compute the universe from the beginning before you can see anything, before the universe has got any structure. The universe started, let's call it a Big Bang for a moment, and it was extraordinarily hot, extraordinarily uniform, except for little variations. The universe actually began, and Roger will correct me if I'm right, that you can see to the horizon. In other words, how long light has taken to get to us over the age of the universe, about 13.7 or so billion years, to that edge. It began from a volume smaller than the nucleus of an atom. And it expanded enormously at the beginning, a thing called time called inflation, but from what, you might ask? And then coasted. But didn't quite coast because gravity was pulling it in. And just like when you throw a ball up, it sort of slows down. But now we know it's also expanding, or accelerating. Now, it wasn't before. Over half the age of the universe has begun accelerating again. And the astonishing thing is that what you can see from this picture represents 5% of the universe. What you can't see is the dark matter and the dark energy, which represents 95% of the universe. And it's the 95% that moulds the 5% that we are. It's actually 4.6% or something. So, how does it mould it? Well, firstly, without the dark matter, you will not get galaxies. Because you need the amount of mass in the dark matter, which we don't know, that pulls the galaxies together, pulls the gaseous stuff together, and allows galaxies to form. It's like having a mountain with a snow on top. The snow doesn't, without the mountain, the snow wouldn't be up there. So, how long have I got that? So it basically, from a beginning where one could just about make out the moons of Jupiter, one is making out the actual, I don't know what to call this, you perceive the whole universe. Whether you know the truth of it is another question. But you need a big telescope to go further. And this is the William Herschel telescope again. And with the Herschel telescope, you generally have the atmosphere making certain changes. It makes the image bigger than the Hubble telescope because the Hubble is above the atmosphere, there's no shimmering. Right. What can you do? Well, actually, from the ground, one can correct for the shimmer. If you measure the shimmer, you can correct for it. And it's called active optics. You make things, compensate for this. And one thing we've done on that is a bigger picture now. You send a laser light to some upper atmosphere and then detect that image, a tiny image, and use that as a sort of template for all the rest of it. You make the corrections on the basis of the imperfection that you see in the image that's come down through the atmosphere, but you say it's the same imperfection as everywhere else, and you can make a sort of computational inversion. And that's what is going to be having to be done with big telescopes as well, and particularly so the next generation telescopes. Let me just quickly go over here. This is the picture of what we've just been speaking of. You see normal galaxies near us. This is Hubble again, because I did want to bring Hubble in a bit, but ground-based telescopes are really most effective in their analysis. They're not quite as good as taking the pictures, but the Hubble images are tiny. In fact, the original images that the deepest camera was taking was a field, a grain of sand in your hand, and held it that far. That was the field. There's enormous detail in it, but it's not much, and you need to survey. Many ground-based telescopes do that too. Anyway, you see what's called the Hubble deep field, or the this image at the top there. That was the first thing. I just showed you the Hubble ultra deep field. It goes out that far. Before that, and it's just to the point where the first galaxies were forming, you saw those little things. As you go on outwards, you come to before anything, no light, no stars. And then you come to something called the radiation era. Now this is, you can see, the microwave background, microwave remnants 300,000 years or so after the Big Bang. And that radiation is detected now at 3 degrees, not its original 3,000 degrees. The universe has expanded 1,000 times since then. And that redshift of 1,000 means the very hot radiation that was showing up visible light at the time, so to speak, it's not visible, no, it's there in that sense, has now been turned into microwaves, radio waves, and one can observe that. It's this is what you observe. The structure there is the universe as it was 300,000 years after the Big Bang, but highly amplified in this picture. The actual detail is one part in 100,000. So if I had the blank screen, it's like that. That's like a blank screen. You don't see the structure. But from that structure, in other words, little blip here is on top of something which is 100,000 times bigger underneath. It's that tiny little ripples. But the universe began like that. It didn't begin like that. The structure began like that. And those little ripples came from this tiny volume where the universe began. Not that there was no universe on either side of that, by the way. I'm just saying the bit we can see started such a long time ago because of the enormous expansion. But who knows how big the universe actually was? It could be an infinite. But the bit that we saw, just a little tiny grain, so to speak, on a beach that we happened to be in. And these variations we can now see in the large scale came from quantum effects in the original. They're microscopic effects nowadays. It's another story in itself. Anyway, you can see that where this first was seen, not that particular image, even if you've got the front page of the Independent, back to creation, they say. Astronomy is really enormously appealing to everybody. So, a quick look at this picture. On the left, inflation, the very tiny volume with quantum fluctuations there, expanding enormously rapidly to begin with. After that, it coasted, and we now see it's accelerating. As you go through it, its time is on, from left to right, 13.7 billion years to now. And as you go along, things start, forming and stuff, and you see the normal galaxies. Actually, this is slightly deceptive because the universe has expanded from the time of this coloured thing I just showed you on the left there, that image that relates to this, that goes to that colouring on the left, is the universe expanded by 1,000 times. It doesn't look it here, but that's actually what's happened. So, you've got this formation of the universe. Is this a mystery to us? Well, actually, we can, as I said a moment ago, we can put it in the computer and we can generate this whole thing. But the interesting thing is, in other words, you put the gas in the universe, that is in the universe originally, in a computer, and make it evolve gravitation from the tiny variations at the very beginning. You find you don't finish up with what you look like now. You do only do that if you put in the dark matter. And you need a certain amount of dark matter, cold dark matter, cold being massive particles that aren't moving too fast, because you need fine structure to form. You can get dark matter, you might say neutrinos, they're too light. They move too fast and they don't allow, they smudge everything out. You need heavy stuff, it's called cold dark matter. And you can then reproduce how the universe looks currently in a computer. But you can't do it without this mysterious dark matter. You also now require the dark energy. And you can see the dark matter directly. Nobody has a clue what the dark energy is. You've got a sort of a clue what the dark matter is. That's 23% of the atoms that we're made of is 4.6. Dark energy is 72%, we have no clue. But here is an example of the effect of dark matter in a galaxy cluster. And these sort of circular things are images of a distant galaxy or different galaxies, multiple images of some, a single galaxy in some cases on this image, which are gravitationally lensed. Gravitation attracts light. Einstein predicted it. Eddington demonstrated it. It happens, you can see it very clearly. People, this is just matter of course stuff nowadays. But without the dark matter, you can't get this image. You have to put it in. So it's there, but we don't know what it is. Furthermore, if you take the properties of the universe, it happens to be in a good range to produce us sitting here. In other words, to allow galaxies and stars to form. If it was going too slowly, it would have recollapsed too quickly. Nothing would have happened. It would have been a fireball and stuff. If it too fast, it never would have allowed galaxies to form. So there's a permitted range, which is quite narrow. And so, I finish like this, almost finish. It may be that we're not in the only universe. This universe happens to be successful for us, and therefore we can talk about it. But what we can't say is whether it's unique or not. If it is unique, we've got to explain it in science. We can't do that yet. One option is that there's a multiverse, there's a population, this is a good one. I mean, if you take a box which is 20 degrees centigrade, another one that is 100, in the 20 degrees box, there's a microbe saying, this is a lovely environment, there's no microbes in the 100 degrees centigrade box. It's effectively that, but it's the whole evolution. We are actually linked, in a funny way, with the universe by actually talking about it, because it's had to produce us to be able to talk about it. There's nothing mystical, it's just a matter of fact. And we'll have to get further with bigger telescopes. This is the ultra-large telescope, extra-large telescope. There's another one which used to be the overwhelmingly large telescope, but that was too big. I think I'd better stop at that point. Thank you very much.
I promised it would last an hour, so we overrun a little bit. So if you need to go, please take a chance to leave now. I'd like to take a couple of questions, and we don't have time for many, but I don't want to detain you if you're expected somewhere else, or you need to be somewhere else. I don't want to embarrass you by not giving you a moment to leave. But if anyone does have any questions, shall we start that now? Anyone got any questions? Yes, the one back.
Trying to persuade people that your new design wasn't crazily outrageous, that it was one practical and it would work.
It was simply engineering. It was a mindset. There had been other examples, like lighter telescopes, more compact telescopes, even a British example. But it was an equatorial mount in that case. But the mindset of those who did the design was different. And it was almost, you could, bunch of, they said, wild horses wouldn't make me change. I remember this phrase. They had to, because the project was cancelled. But it wasn't funded. It had to be half the price, literally. And it was 18 million, this doesn't sound much nowadays, this was in 1979, 18 million, the research council said no, and I said it could be 9 million, I said 8 million plus instruments, and we built it for that, with inflation, eventually, you have to include, but it was for that price, and it was accepted. And without making this design, which is better in the sense of be more effective as a telescope and no less of an aperture, would never have been, we would have been way behind. So it was one brought in a different bunch of people to do it. However, I should say, and this is not, I realise I'm sounding negative, there's a certain mindset which got them there because a lot of people big telescopes around, so let's make one like it. But some outside people came in, I was one of them. But the people who designed that telescope originally also designed this one, the final one, and they joined in. In other words, it wasn't easy. When the coin flipped, when the record flipped, we all worked together, and it was done very well. It's there were not people sort of fighting each other. They saw the light.
Now, two people beside each other at the back who want to ask a question. They're here and we'll fight about it. Roger, you can maybe put your hand up first.
Professor, I wanted to ask you a couple of quick ones. What was the size of the team that supports the Herschel telescope? You mentioned you need a large team with a lot of expertise. How many people are out there doing this?
Well, of course, you've got to count everybody. There's people in the observatory, 50 or 60. Then there's people in the companies that actually do the building.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, 100. In the end, it's very many people if you take everything. There's those that did the civil engineering, the telescope, and so on. So, but if you just take the core team, you have to have all the knowledge, 50 or 60. And then running the observatory was about 60 people,
yeah,
actually resident there. Of course, it had been built, but you need to still have skill range, and which includes astronomers and technicians. Sorry, I won't say technicians, engineers and technicians, and people even sweeping up, which I did, probably. So, no, forget the sweeping up thing. It's not just two, you know. In the old days, one person ran a telescope. But of course, look, I've been to Palomar, I've been to Mount Wilson. And Mount Wilson, famous place, Hubble worked there. There's one person there overnight. And in fact, you walked up with your plates, photographic plates. One of the astronomers walked up, realized it was the wrong place, walked down again. So it was a different thing. And what's more, you look through eyepieces and stuff like that. And when I began with Palomar, we did look through eyepieces because it was Palomar. But we attached the modern detector. In fact, the detector for faint objects made a factor of 1,000 difference to the speed, to the data gathering. Because emulsion has, if you look at very faint things, it's got a sort of threshold. You come to a point, you see nothing. But if you look at really faint objects, this had no threshold, just every photon counted, literally. So it made an enormous difference to even a big telescope. Because it was always with a telescope striving to do the best you can with it. You don't sort of do the same things with a big one as with a small one. So it's always different, whichever one you have. And it was, you know, once you get things like that into the photography, you know, technology and technical people, this is a big difference between then and now. There's not much difference in getting money, you know, it's all different ways of doing it. There's certain excitement, and Roger will convey that with Gemini, mm-hmm, and other things that we'll talk about. And incidentally, Hubble, I mentioned the International Ultraviolet Explorer, sorry, TD1A, the sexy title, took 2 years to build, scan the sky in the ultraviolet. The International Ultraviolet Explorer, as I mentioned, took 9 years, it was 18 years in space. Hubble telescope took 20 years, and now it's been in orbit for 18 or 19. So, you know, there's a lot of effort, but there's a lot of payoff as well in this sense. But I didn't think I could go through yet another really working at those sort of expanding timescales, another spacecraft, so I can actually get something on the ground. And in the Hubble telescope, we got the Palmer Bay Observatory going without the Hubble telescope, without the William Herschel telescope in about 4 years, the other telescope, and then another three finished the William Herschel telescope.
I'd better ration you. I mean, there's so many people. One question each, surely, Roger. No?
Okay.
Right, this is a really vital one.
I just wanted to ask, what's been the fate of the Isaac Newton telescope?
When you say fate, it's a good point. People think you have smaller telescopes, they don't work. Actually, they use for different purposes. Survey stuff, wide field of prime focus, astonishingly effective. And a better example of the Isaac Newton telescope, it seems smaller. Roughly a 100-inch telescope. It's transformed the knowledge of the galaxy population in the wide field of stuff, because it's dedicated in that task, and one takes images and spectra. It's the Sloan telescope, Roger. You use it, I'm sure, and it's not a big telescope. So they all have their different roles, and they don't necessarily have to disappear.
I think the famous Roger had his hand back, did he?
No.
Oh, he didn't. We'll hear from Roger in a couple of weeks. If you're all wondering who Roger might be.
Roger is one of your lecturers.
Yeah. But the chap at the very back of the question, that my man, do you hand up?
Yeah. I'm wondering if there's a new generation of telescopes that you envision coming online that will be able to see deeper than the image that you showed, the Hubble, how far back they're able to look. If do you have anything to say about technologies that are being developed now, or in philosophers' fantasies, what's next?
Yeah, well, there is, of course. There's a Sun of Hubble, which is a bigger telescope, and working in the infrared, or dominant at least. And the point about infrared is the further away you look, the more redshifted is the object. So if you want to go really to enormous distances, you need to actually chase the light in wavelength. So it's a bigger telescope with a dominance of, I don't know if it's all infrared or maybe it's optical as well, but you're pushing in that direction. So bigger and more suited to high, more distant objects. But the advantage of being above the atmosphere, by the way, in the infrared, the atmosphere is very bright. Even the optical region is quite bright. When you go to the sky is low. So what you do on the ground is have enormous telescopes, and you, of course, can go very deep as well, very, very deep. But the advantage of the enormous telescope is you can split the light up, analyze the light of very distant objects, so you can't do that from space. They're not big enough. And that's the advantage. So you work in a complementary way.
The future's probably a good place to end for now, and to be perfectly honest, the staff are only ahead for another 7 minutes. But thank you very much indeed for coming, and next week Phil Diamond will be here from John Robine to talk about the history of John Robine. And all that remains is to thank again Professor Boxenberg for a fascinating lecture. Thank you very much indeed.